Okay, welcome everyone to our session here on FOIA and tech. My name is Amelia Ascari, and I teach environmental journalism at the University of Michigan. I'm going to be moderating today, and we have a couple of terrific speakers to share their experiences with FOIA with you. Directly to my left is Tim Wheeler, who heads SEJ's FOIA Task Force. Tim is an extremely experienced journalist, and has fought many FOIA battles, both on behalf of his own reporting and on behalf of our community, and has experiences even trying to promote legislation, because of course FOIA is a federal law and a state law in each state. Under SEJ's status as a 501c3 nonprofit, we cannot lobby on any kind of political candidate-related issue, but we can step forward on specific legislation that relates to journalism, and Tim has led the effort for some years on that. So big thanks to him, and I look forward to hearing what he has to share on tips for everybody as they move through a Freedom of Information Act request. And then to Tim's left,
Jaya.
Jaya Padmanabhan is joining us. She's a very distinguished journalist from San Francisco and a member of that city's FOIA task force, representing the Society of Professional Journalists on that task force. So she has some really interesting case studies to share with us and insights from her work on this task force, which is attempting to mediate FOIA requests that are being received and maybe perhaps not immediately responded to by government officials in San Francisco. So we had a third speaker lined up for this session from the Google News Initiative, and I can tell you that it took a lot of work to even find her email and talk with her. And I am really sad to say that she is canceled at the last minute. She said she could not get funding to attend. And I think we all know that there have been lots of layoffs at Google. And so perhaps that is related to that situation. I do, she is a person who has journalism and blogging experience and an interest in environmental health issues. So I do hope that she is still working at Google next year and we can perhaps get her at our next, to speak at our next conference. So my apologies that we don't have that strong tech angle represented, but I will say just a few words about myself. Uh-oh. Something happened here. Hello?
Maybe the battery?
Oh.
No, there's one.
Okay, I turned it off and back on.
Still on.
Okay. Yep. So let's have our friend come back. I am a former reporter for the Miami Herald, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, and the Detroit Free Press. Before I went to teach more substantially in terms of a time commitment, I have a master's in journalism and went back to get a master's in human-computer interaction. I enjoyed that work so much that I continued on to get a PhD in education technology. And I have recently, which I've recently completed about a year ago, and did dissertation work related to using social media in civic ways to teach in high school. So very journalism related. So I have some thoughts to share related to technology, and I invite anybody who has interest in sharing any of their experiences using technology and reporting or presentation of their reporting to not be shy. We'll have some time after our speakers to walk around with a mic that we hope will get some batteries soon. And hear some of your stories and tips, because we are, SEJ is a community where we all learn from each other and support each other. And we will also have time to answer or have discussion around your FOIA battles. So I am tasked as the moderator here with keeping time and managing the question and answers. You will have SEJ members and other journalists will have the priority in terms of asking questions during that section of the session today. And I'm also tasked with reminding everybody that SEJ is asking you to wear a mask if you are not actively speaking or eating or drinking. I have a few more instructions during the Q&A. Right now, let's turn to you, Tim.
Okay.
And here's the microphone back here.
Right, now we've got all kinds of microphones. I'll speak in stereo. Hi, I'm Jim Wheeler. I'm associate editor and senior writer for the Bay Journal, the other Bay, the Chesapeake Bay. I've been the chair of SEJ's Freedom of Information Task Force for too many years. So if anybody would like to be any other FOI, sunshine fanatics are out there, we welcome them. We can use all the help we can get. I sort of come into this with the idea that maybe this should be a sharing session rather than us downloading a lot of knowledge to you, because judging from the folks who signed up on Google, are indicated they weren't just here, and I assume that some of them actually came. There was some pretty experienced-looking journalists in there who probably have had some experience with this. How many of you have filed FOIA requests before? Okay, most everybody. How many have not? Never filed? One over here, two here. Okay. How many of you have filed a state public records request? Again, almost as many people. How many have not filed a state public records request? Okay, a few there too. So I don't need to. I have a PowerPoint I do, which is all about the basics of FOIA. I don't think I really need to go through that. If we get into specifics or you have a particular issue, we can talk about the different aspects. I'm happy to share that with those who are not here. And we can talk a little bit about your FOIA law. Does anybody not even know what FOIA is?
Tim, I think it would be a good idea to at least say a few words about it, since we do have some people who haven't experienced it yet.
Yeah.
But not spend a ton of time on it, and then maybe direct them to a website where, one of the FOIA generators, perhaps?
Yeah.
Okay.
The law itself goes back even before my time, and I'm pretty old, in covering journalism. It was first passed in 1966, and it basically says that you, the public, not just journalists, but anybody, has a right to access government documents and government information, with certain exceptions, and there are nine of them, and some of them are pretty broad. And when it was originally passed, it specified that the government had to respond within 20 working days, which is just, roughly about a month. At the beginning, when I was first doing reporting in the 70s, it worked pretty much like that, at least on simple requests, and some even more complex. It's dragged out since then. The task force just did a report for Sunshine Week in March that sort of took a look at what the FOIA backlogs were like. And we found that EPA, for instance, the average length of time for them to respond to a simple request, we were just asking for a few documents, was 8 weeks. So roughly twice what the law specifies they have to do. and longer ones took 6 months, which is more complex ones. And that's an improvement because it's been as much as a year on average. I mean, we're talking some requests take much longer. I was just looking at the EPA FOIA requests, and there were some that are pending from years ago. So it works like that. Interior Department, simple request took 6 months. So they can, you gotta wait a while. If you're on deadline, that's not that very much help. So there are challenges with that. There's some things you could do to speed it up, and we can talk about those. Maybe what I would like to know is, what we can do to help you. How many of you, when you filed a FOIA request, got what you wanted? Raise your hands. A few, okay. So not so many. Anybody who filed a request, I mean, what we want to do here is maybe figure out how we can help you. Anybody out there who wants to volunteer what happened and why you were frustrated? Nope? Okay.
I'll just share my latest, which was more of a right to know as a state.
We got to use the microphone.
Can you walk up here? Is
that one still out?
It's on.
I mean, this is a...
Identify yourself.
Oh, yeah, Dave Reed Frazier, Allegheny Front, public radio show in Pittsburgh, focusing on the environment. I filed a right to know request for, correspondence about a particular project that was going through the governor's office. And it's a bit of a success story, but ultimately not. I got a 900 pages of emails, and they're mostly it just took forever to go through, and they're mostly just, hey, let's circle back next week. Let's touch base. And it's like that little, because anyway, it's a, there's also we don't have those records, even though, or you're not specific enough, or a lot of them are in the state law that's pre-decisional, if we're debating whether or not to, fire Tim or somebody, that those are sort of privileged. So I don't know, there's a bunch of caveats that you're not allowed to get access to. So.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, that sort of hits on some of the key points here. If you're gonna file a FOIA request, one of the bits of advice that the experts would give you is do a little research first, see what you can find out through the public record or through sources about what it is you need to know or you want to know. And then try to narrow your request down as much as possible, assuming that it is to those specific things, because you can get, as you found out, you can get a boatload of documents and then you find yourself wading through a lot of dross in order to try to find those nuggets of hard information that you need. And the other thing you mentioned was that you didn't get some of the key stuff you were looking for because it was probably covered by exemptions. Personnel, legal stuff, pre-decisional. So maybe that's one of those very broad categories of exemption. And these are, the state public records laws are all different in some respects. They're similar, largely similar, but they also have their variations and differences. And so you can find yourself hung up on one of those exemptions and be stuck. Another thing you can run into is you can be done a lot of money, especially at the state level, for records requests. I have discovered lately that I am generally done at least $1,000 anytime I ask for something. And then you enter into this process. You have $1,000, we won't open the search until you tell us you will pay at least $1,000. And otherwise you have to negotiate to reduce your request, reduce the fee. Some states even, in fact, won't process requests from out-of-state residents. So that's something you have to think about. But the key is narrow your request and follow up on it. Those are some of the things we would recommend. Anyway, let's turn, it's all right, I've used up my 5 minutes to start with. We can come back to this and talk about some other things. But I think Jaya has an interesting case study of a local government that actually has a sunshine ordinance. Essentially, they have legislated transparency within the bounds of San Francisco. Does anybody in here know of a local sunshine ordinance or a freedom of information ordinance? with their local government? You have your hand up?
Vaguely, small time reporting for.
Take your mask off so we can hear you.
Everybody should please announce.
Oh, I'm a journalism student at the University of Missouri.
Welcome.
Yes.
I was on a beat for like some small town reporting and some of the towns that have plenty of sunshine.
Good. Good. All right. But this is a big city and they have a lot of issues. So
yeah, you want to give a rundown, quick rundown?
Sure. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Amelia. Welcome everybody. My name is Jaya Padmanabhan, and I am a member of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force in San Francisco. And this ordinance was passed about 30 years ago, and the ordinance established the task force as a body that would oversee sunshine complaints and also advise the Board of Supervisors and Mayor. And there are 11 other cities that have a sunshine ordinance, but nothing as expansive in California, I'm talking about, but nothing as expansive as San Francisco's sunshine laws. In the city of Chicago, there's a tax increment financing sunshine ordinance that was passed. St. Louis has a sunshine ordinance that was approved in 2007. None of them are as expansive as San Francisco's sunshine law ordinance. And so the task force has 11 voting members, and some of them are journalists. I'm a journalist. I was appointed by the Society of Professional Journalists. And there are, I believe, there's one more journalist on the task force. There are a few lawyers, and there are mostly people who are interested in citizen advocacy. And if anyone believes that the city, county of San Francisco has not complied with the Sunshine Ordinance, the Public Records Act, or the Ralph M. Brown Act, which is for open meetings, public meetings, a complaint may be filed with the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. And the task force meets every first Wednesday of the month. And I have to say that the Sunshine Ordinance I'm going to briefly go over some of the work that we did last year. And we have produced an annual report, which I believe I have put up somewhere. It's a PDF. And if anyone wants to see that annual report, it is actually a progress report of how San Francisco deals with its sunshine complaints and record requests. I'll briefly run through some of the main points of the annual report. So last year, San Francisco received 13,999 record requests. That's a large number. And it reflects how engaged San Francisco is with the government. And you're fine? And of these 13,999, only 1% of complaints of records ended up as complaints to the task force. So, and that actually, it doesn't really say much other than the fact that there are a lot of people who actually make record requests and don't want to go through the process of actually filing a sunshine complaint. The mean response time for record requests across all bodies, all administrative bodies in San Francisco was 10 days.
And our ordinance says, and it aligns with the time allowed by the Sunshine Ordinance, which is that any record request needs to be fulfilled within 10 days, unless it's an immediate disclosure request, which means 24 hours. So, the official complaints, of the official complaints that came to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force, there were 55 that we actually heard in all of 2022. And out of which only 5 of them did we find no violation on the part of the government. So we are, so as a task force, we're a strong advocate for petitioners. But I'll tell you what the problem with the Sunshine Task Force is. At the start of 2023, there were about 170 complaints backlogged. And this means that the time it takes the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force to adjudicate one complaint is, the ordinance states that we must adjudicate or resolve these complaints within 45 days. Mm. It takes 4 times more than that time. And I think that's just, one, because of the backlog that we have. 2, because each complaint goes through a subcommittee and then comes to the main committee. And I sit on subcommittees where I decide whether a complaint falls within the jurisdiction of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. I mean, mostly they do. Sometimes, in a few rare occasions, they don't. And here's the other thing. There are a few people who contribute a majority of the complaints. So I can tell you that there is one person who has generated more than 50 complaints. Okay.
You mean government person?
No, it's not a government
person. Oh, an individual.
It's an individual, you know. And this person is actually a very, very interesting person because, he's anonymous. And or they are anonymous, and they started this work as an agitator, insisting that the government needed to comply with record requests, and wanted to find out how they did that, and if they followed all the protocols. And I think so. Anonymous, and if you Google anonymous San Francisco Sunshine, you'll find a lot of cases there. And one of the cases that he insisted on was Prop G calendar. So the calendars of mayors and board heads and commissioners must be available to the public. So he asked the mayor for her calendar. And the mayor sent calendar, but he realized it didn't have all the details. So he pushed and he pushed. And finally, the mayor released a calendar filled with a lot more details. I mean, it came to the task force and went back to the mayor, and the mayor finally released a calendar filled with a lot more details. And it was then discovered that the mayor has a secret calendar, which is kept for non-public records requests. And one which she makes available to people who ask for more information. I do believe that this anonymous has actually broken a lot of news stories in San Francisco. And you can see the power of one individual. And I have to really raise this because it just takes one voice. And some of the biggest stories in San Francisco in the last 2 years, including the Recology corruption case, was as a result of Anonymous's work. I do believe last year he received the Freedom of Information Medal for his work. I wanted to put that out there.
Did he receive it anonymously?
He did receive it anonymously.
Good for Anonymous. And I just point out that that request for an official calendar and with details is a classic FOIA request that usually yields a good story, you know, in conjunction with other reporting, obviously. Some years ago in my city, at my old newspaper, the Detroit Free Press, the mayor's calendar, was part of the evidence that led to further reporting that led to criminal conviction for that mayor. It certainly is powerful. I also want to point out that if there are any people who haven't filed FOIA requests, in the past and are concerned about the exact language, which is a legal kind of language, there are some generators out there that will generate the correct language for your state when you add information about what you want to request. Your state and also the federal FOIA. Freedom of Information Act. One that I recommend to my students is the Student Press Law Center. And I can pull that up in a few minutes.
Slide.
You have it on slide?
No.
Well, okay. I just wanted to throw that in kind of early in the conversation in case in case somebody was feeling like, I don't know how I'll ever do this. It's easy. The hard part is narrowing the request so that it's going to be something that will get a good response. And then having persistence. I often tell my students that, in my opinion, one of the key differences between a professional journalist and somebody who's doing journalism as a hobby or just something on the side that maybe is not paid is that is basically an attorney. That those of us who have the experience of working for a news organization with a strong attorney who will back you up on getting the information you want, that's critical. And also, this is not so much FOIA related, but when you are using the Freedom of Information Act, one definition of journalism is that you're trying to get information and share publicly information that people don't want anyone else to know, right? So when you are, and that often involves the Freedom of Information Act, and when you are doing that kind of journalism, you are often going to be threatened with a lawsuit. You have to be completely correct and have all of your accurate information from multiple sources. And there's where a lawyer also helps you face down people who may be threatening you just to try and scare you off, even though you have solid information on them.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, there's one other organization that does a letter generator or sample letters for you. That's the National Freedom of Information Coalition. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, segueing from Amelia's comment about it helps to have a lawyer in your pocket, actually provides for a FOIA hotline, a legal assistance hotline, if you get other kinds of legal questions too. And they provide free legal assistance in some states, not all. So that's a program they started a few years ago. They have a very good FOIA wiki. If you really want to dive deep into the intricacies of this, go to their FOIA wiki. They used to have a letter generator, but they have sort of taken that part down. I'm not quite sure why, but the wiki is there for you to dive in. And these sample letters, you're always going to have to tailor your letter to specifically what you want. And there are tricks. How many of you have had to pay fees in order to get your records? A lot, yeah. FOIA provides for you to ask for a fee waiver, and the federal government generally does recognize journalists as eligible for waivers. Unfortunately, my state does not. Yes?
What's the difference on
the
wiki?
It's the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and then you go to their website or just put in FOIA wiki and it should pop up. I don't know if I've got that on this slide or not. Likewise, you can ask for expedited handling of a FOIA. That's maybe a bit less successful. But it's, again, something where you can invoke that there is some urgency. Generally, usually, to be successful, you have to say that life and health are at risk. Some urgency to why you need to have it sooner than 6 months from now. So. Where do we want to go from here?
I just want to point out that the session is being recorded, as all the sessions at the SEJ conference are. So one of my roles is to stand up here with this mobile mic. We do want to capture your questions and not have to repeat them. So that's what I'm going to be doing. And I want to remind people that we need you to identify yourselves and your affiliation when you are asking a question. And if we have too many questions or comments or case studies that you want us to workshop here right now, then SCJ members and other journalists are go to the front of the line. So do you want to move into that?
We could do that, yeah. Okay. Just let me mention a little bit about the task force. We do intercede for individual problems. We've done a lot lately on just getting general reporter access. Not with a lot of success with the federal government, frankly. It's been a deteriorating condition that's gone back well before the Trump administration in terms of declining ability to actually interview real people in the federal government. You generally have to go through press people, and you generally have to wind up emailing your questions, and you get an emailed response, which is often non-responsive, and it may or may not come in on deadline. We can try, with at least the environmental agencies, to try to help you with that. At the beginning of the Biden administration, I did make contact with the press secretaries for Interior and EPA. We had webinars with them. They promised to work to be more open. They have made some steps at that. It's a little better, but it's not a lot better. And in some ways, it's just the same old story. We do have some links on the SCJ website for help with FOIA. To be candid, some of them are not working right now. I just went back and looked at them. This is like when you're in your hometown, you never take the tourist. So I just scrolled through before the conference and said, oh my God, some of these links are broken. So we're going to update that. This slideshow that we're not going to show you because it's kind of going to take too long will be on that website. It's got the basics in there for those who have never filed one and want to work their way through it. Do people have questions or problems they want to share?
Hi, I'm Kylie Moore. I'm a reporter for the magazine High Country News. And I have a question about appeals. I recently got a response back from the Forest Service to a FOIA. And the whole PowerPoint that I had requested was exempted due to the deliberative process privilege. So I'm wondering if any of you all have strategies or approaches to appealing specifically that exemption or appealing in general. Thanks.
Okay. What I can tell you generally is, there's two levels of appeal, administrative and then getting a lawyer or going to court. Jimmy Tobias, a member of the task force who unfortunately couldn't be here for this conference, has done a lot of FOIAs, and he advises basically, go ahead and appeal if you're denied. The first level of appeal, you can simply write a letter. You don't need a lawyer necessarily to do that, and challenge them. And that kicks it up one level for review, and he said he had had some success with that. If you don't get any response from that, then you can file a legal appeal. I know it's discouraging. I filed one once asking the National Science Foundation why they had canceled a grant for an environmental study in Baltimore. And the FLAC told me, we don't discuss our grant decisions. And I said, well, you must have made some reason for it. And I filed a FOIA, and they came back and said, we have no records. Well, I know that was not true. But by that time, my deadline was passed, so I had to go on with the story. Anybody here have had experience with appeals? Has anybody gone that? You want to share your experience? Yeah. Whether it worked or not, it's worth knowing.
Hi.
Tell us who you are.
Yeah, my name is David Pomerantz. I run a watchdog organization with some utilities called the Energy and Policy Institute. We do a lot of FOIA, state level. and we get denied a lot, and we appeal pretty often. I would say generally not a super high success rate for administrative appeal. Sometimes when they're blatantly wrong, we can, it's sort of like calling a manager. Sometimes
shake something loose.
Sometimes you shake something loose, particularly if they're, abusing either of the two most common exemptions, deliberative or trade secrets, are the two that we run into all the time.
Right.
So sometimes it works. Usually we have to sue, and thankfully we have some resources to be able to do that.
Do you have a lawyer on staff? Or on retainer?
On retainer.
Okay.
Yeah. And I know that that's not available to everyone. I will say sometimes, like, even just having a letter from a lawyer can sort of shake some things loose. It's even if it's a little bit of a bluff, but just to show that you have counsel can make a difference. It sort of puts it into another zone for the public information staff.
Sure. Those are all good strategies. Over here.
Yeah, now while I'm walking over there, I'll say that in news organizations where I worked, reporters did not have permission to file FOIA without first talking to one of the top editors in the newsroom, because our policy was that if you filed FOIA, we were all in and we were going to go to court to get that information. So we didn't want to go all in on something that's too big that we wouldn't get. So just to build a reputation, our lawyer, Herschel Fink, whose daughter is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter at the New York Times now, is a fearsome name to many people working on responding to FOIAs at a national level. So we wanted to consult with him before we filed even the first request to make sure that he thought it was tight and that we were going to be able to win.
I'm Aaron Weiss with the Center for Western Priorities and recovering journalist now on the advocacy side, but we did a lot of FOIA work, particularly around interior during the Trump administration. And one of the most powerful tools is to FOIA your FOIA as a bit of a side door to an appeal, because learning how that FOIA that got redacted with those overzealous B5 exemptions, the deliberative exemptions, is to see who touched the FOIA and how far up the food chain. And in the case of the Trump administration, that eventually led to uncovering an illegal policy at Interior where political appointees were interfering with FOIA releases, and that got Congress's attention and eventually did result in a change in Interior policy.
Amelia, I have something to add to that. So one of the tools that San Francisco has now begun to use is this platform called Next Request. It is supposed to make requests very visible to anybody. And also, if you want to file a FOIA and you see someone else has already downloaded those documents, it's easy to go and kind of look it up and procure them. However, it's been a few years and there is a transition towards Next Request, but I did an analysis of Next Request this year, and I found that many of the requests, out of the 7,235 requests that were made on Next Request in San Francisco, only 3,500 of them were actually visible. So the whole platform itself is not transparent. So we're actually making a push this year to have, including requesters, cannot see their own requests. So we're making a push to actually move towards making that completely available to the public, because I think that solves a lot of problems. And you can immediately see the who it was assigned to, in which department, and all that. So I think tools like that really work if they're used right.
I think that's super interesting. I just want to say, obviously collaborative journalism is a very powerful movement, and one of the kind of challenges as a journalist is that we work still in a competitive environment. If we could remove that competition barrier and share everything we got from FOIA, that would be a different world, you know, for journalists. And it might be something I would like to, of course, it's easy for me to say that now I'm working at the university, but I would like to see us move toward that because I think it's in the public interest. And I think it it also helps demonstrate to the public what journalists do, how far they're willing to go, which even if we write a little story about it when we're publishing our investigation, not everybody's going to see it, people are going to forget it, and so I encourage further discussion on this in the future, perhaps even today here if there's interest. Because one tiny quick anecdote on my way over here, this morning, I shared an Uber with one of my former students who's now working as one of our fellows here. And she was telling me about a FOIA situation where she got a database from another journalist and she simply went back to the agency to verify the information because she didn't get it directly. And the agency wants to charge her $1,800 to verify this information that it took her 2 hours to analyze. So so who does that serve, you know? Anyway.
Okay. We'll have your hand up over here.
Thank you, Master.
Hey, I'm Bryce Gray. I'm a reporter with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I often joke that Missouri doesn't live up to its show-me state when it comes to FOIA laws. This is a question for any of you, or you, David, I'd be curious. So I cover a lot of energy stuff in our state, and we're a regulated monopoly utility state. And of course, I've always thought there should be, at least in principle, a compelling argument there for these monopoly utility companies to have to be, almost hold themselves to the standards that a government agency would in terms of transparency. Maybe that's wishful thinking on my part as a journalist, but I guess I'm curious if any of you know of successful legal arguments or examples where utilities have to, I guess, cough stuff up through either FOIA requests. I mean, I guess the way into this, or kind of the only window, at least in Missouri, is, you know, when they come forward for certain things before the state, there's a regulatory process, and a lot of those documents are available through an admittedly pretty clunky website and back and forth process, but there are still redactions that I run into. You know, I certainly understand why some things, would need to be withheld, but I'm always hoping for more, and I'm wondering if you guys know of any, again, either examples or, legal arguments where you can kind of pry things back, pry back that curtain.
I'm not aware of any state, local, or federal laws that mandate private corporations disclose their inner workings to the public. However, you just touched on the main window into that, which is through regulatory agencies. And in a state where the utility is regulated, they have to file all kinds of financial information to get a rate set. And they have to, disclose other information to the regulators. Then the challenge is, does the regulatory agency give you what you need to report, and is the law transparent enough in that regard? And one thing I would say, too often we tend to not want the, we've been taught, certainly old school journalists like me have been taught, that we're not the story, we're supposed to be telling the story. But I think it's time that we tell the story of how hard it is to get information that we want to tell, that we think the public deserves to know. And so if you're denied a request, why not write about it? Yeah. If you're being done, I mean, this is something that we've talked about in my shop, is that we're being done to $1,000 plus as a sort of a new thing in the last couple of years since the pandemic. Maybe it's time to write about it. Maybe it's time to disclose it. Reach out. If you're being done that kind of money, what do you think the members of the public, community groups, are being done? What kind of experience are they having?
I just want to point out that if you want national context for your story about what your agency is trying to charge you, Tim's committee released a very interesting report. Didn't talk about
That was mainly on backlogs and handling of the time. What I wanted to sort of pose, and Amelia just volunteered to be on the task force because she suggested a collaborative project. We haven't paid enough attention to state public records requests, and they vary all over the lot. I mean, in Maryland, we have a court case, an appellate court case right now, where the police department in Baltimore was asked to release body camera footage of arrests, a suite of arrests where people thought that they had, you know, been abusive, and this was by human rights groups and civil rights groups. And they initially refused to give any away, and then they were told by court they had to give them away. And then they said, okay, well, we're entitled to recover our costs. You're gonna have to pay $89,000. So that's gone to the Maryland Appeals Court. This kind of thing is happening all over. How many of you would be interested in participating in your state in filing if we pick a particular topic, filing a state records request, and then sharing the results, how quickly you got them, what you got, what you had to pay for it, for a national report on how sunshine doesn't shine everywhere. Yes? All right. You're all on record. We'll be in touch.
Take a picture. But seriously, please respond in the Uber app where we all can see it. And. I think that could be really powerful. And meanwhile, if you're doing the story about your individual request, even though task force report came out just a month ago, not long ago, it's recent, and even though it doesn't include information on costs, I still think pointing out that what's happening to you is part of a national trend that is, bogging down the public's right to know puts context on your story and makes it more valuable. So have a look at that report. That is on the SEJ website.
Right. And the point about FOIA requests, when you do that, you can also maybe see through that who has gotten the information, who's already asked for the information you are asking for. I stumbled across, when I filed a FOIA on the Chesapeake Bay restoration effort with EPA, I asked to see some documents on a case that was just settled this week. There was a remarkable bit of transparency on their part. They called up and said, your FOIA request overlaps with one filed by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And so they said, would you mind if we sort of paired them together? We're gonna give them theirs first, we'll give you what we're giving them, and then we'll finish up with the extra stuff that you asked for. And so, one of the points with the watchdog groups, with environmental groups, community groups, the ones you know about, if it's a topic of interest, they may have already filed a request. And some of them may actually have a budget for a lawyer. So that's another avenue to get the same information you're looking for faster. Doesn't answer the question about how can we get the FOIA request handled sooner, but in terms of you getting your story, there is that option. Question over here.
Can I just add something to that? Used to cover energy environment.
Yeah, the session is being recorded, and so that's why
I'm
trying to get this on.
Hi, my name is Miranda Green. I'm Director of Investigations at Floodlight News. For years, I covered energy environment, the EPA Interior Department out of D.C. So I will add another trick to what you just mentioned is you can often see what FOIA requests have been filed. And so if you were interested in something that, let's say, a competitor has already filed for, you can file for it and get the documents at the same time they get it too. Right. So that speeds up the process. You can kind of piggyback onto their request. And another hack, instead of FOIAing the FOIA, is you can FOIA your name. And you can also see how you've been talked about by that agency, right, what they're doing with your request. And there's been some very interesting stories, especially during the Trump administration, that came out having to do that. So.
That's a good point. Used to be that you could actually look those up online through FOIA online. Sadly, the federal government is taking that down as of September. So if there is a portal through the FOIA.gov to file your requests, and you can still file that FOIA request to see the requests, but it's not instantly available anymore. It won't be after a while. I just checked again today, and you call up FOIA online, and it has a little notice at the top and says this is going out of business in September. And some agencies have already stopped participating in it. Question over here? No?
Wait, we're back here?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jenny Splitter. I'm managing editor of Sentient Media. So we're a small nonprofit outlet that covers the impacts of animal ag. And I'm very new to filing FOIA requests. I've only done one. But I wanted to look into sort of USDA's Climate Smart Agriculture programs. And my understanding is there's a professor at the University of Iowa who did file a FOIA request. But basically everything was redacted just to get more information about which projects were funded. And everything was redacted, based on it being trade secret. So I'm wondering if you have any advice about getting, I don't know, challenging that or,
I don't. I haven't run into the trade secret, but again, that's something you could appeal. If, you know, it helps if you have some inside information to know that they are clearly violating that. If everything's redacted, you've got a pretty good hunch that it's that they've gone overboard. Because it can't be everything is a trade secret. In some cases, some agencies will basically say, they give the company a chance to check a box and say it's a trade secret, and they don't ever challenge it or question it themselves. If you appeal, that might force them to go back and look at it. So that is one option.
Also, in my experience, it obviously helps to have somebody inside the agency that's a source of yours who can tell you exactly what the issue is and how to write around it with your request. I mean, it's ideal if you can talk to that person before you file a request, and so you know that your request is as narrow as possible, and that's when you're challenging, it can be helpful if you can find somebody who will tell you from inside the agency how to challenge it.
One thing you could do, and this the animal rights groups and others have done this, is there have been government-funded research in universities, and you can FOIA the university for that, for the records of that researcher, and emails. I mean, it's not the universities and the professors don't like it because they feel like it's an invasion of privacy. There's some good stories out of that about collusion with industry among government-funded researchers. And so, that is definitely another avenue. Sure, when you're, especially FOIA communications, FOIA both ends of the line, if you can. If this is a regulatory issue, you typically, a federal agency and a state government are both involved, you can FOIA them both. I mean, FOIA the one and then use the public records law for the other one, and or the FOIA law, and see if you can't shake stuff loose. Sometimes you get very interesting responses. One will give you more than the other. That tells you something right there.
Right. I've seen two ends of a request like that contradict each other. Some person saying, this is only a draft, and giving it to me. And the other person saying, no, that was not part of the conversation when they sent it out to a larger group of people. So the person who told me this was just a draft magically disappeared from their place of employment. But it's interesting, too. Violating, this was a state, in Michigan, we call it the State Freedom of Information Act, and even though it's a law of the state of Michigan, violating that law, maybe it will cause you to be removed from your job, but to try to get anybody to press anything, misdemeanor or something like that, was not going to happen.
Well, penalties, if they exist in the law at all, are rarely invoked. I mean, Jaya, your sunshine ordinance, any of those violators get fired or put in jail or fined or even hand slapped?
No, I mean, but there are, there are people who keep going at it and look at the same FOIA request from different angles. And oftentimes all of those come to the sunshine, and we hear the same sort of complaint over and over again against the same agency. You know, I mean, it's improving now, but, you know, I do see that there are a lot of gaps to fill. But my question for everybody, what is, have you ever written a FOIA story? You have?
Yeah.
I think I wrote that story he mentioned about the interior department, yeah. Yeah, they were, with the story he mentioned, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're being recorded, so we want to try
yes.
Yes, I did write a FOIA story. I wrote the story that was mentioned previously about the Interior Department. The EPA was also doing this under Trump, but I think the Interior Department was doing it the most egregiously, where they were letting basically senior officials look at the FOIA requests that referenced them before they released them, which is not something you should be doing. And obviously, you can make the argument for them suggesting things to not be released to reporters by doing so. And so that was a pretty, and then they try to do major overhauls of the FOIA process within the agencies to try to, again, slow down the release. And I will say that most of the FOIAs I filed were in 2016 and 2017, and I'm still receiving them back today.
That figures, yeah. The Interior in particular moved during the Trump administration to change their FOIA regulations in just that way. They built in various levels of review up the chain that included political appointees, and they were called on by the public interest groups and SEJ and other journalism groups weighed in also, because they were doing it through the regulatory process. There was public notice and they had to take comment, and there was a lot of pushback, including those who said this violates not only the spirit but the letter of the law. And ultimately they dropped that part. The bad news is that Interior is among the worst in terms of responses to this day for almost any kind of FOIA request, even simple ones. Back here.
Hi, I'm Joan Myers, a client for Arizona Republic. I just had a question related to the length of time it takes sometimes to get records back. And I filed FOIAs using my Gmail account, and then also filed state requests using my Arizona Republic account, but I'm wondering if anybody has thoughts on advantages or disadvantages of, you know, with the volatility of journalism and people changing positions so often, of being the hazard of being in a situation where you found a request and then by the time records are compiled, you're no longer at that email address or something like that. Are there tricks to doing that? Because I imagine, you know, it appears maybe they take it more seriously if you're submitting your request from your newsroom account, but then you're, you know, maybe there's some security in submitting it from Gmail.
That's a good question. I mean, it seems like the process, the people who actually process the FOIA requests are career employees typically. I know in dealing with my State Department of the Environment in Maryland, they basically say, you're just, you know, another person filing, and we have 50 environmental consultants ahead of you, and when we get done with them, we'll get to you. So there's that. There is the prospect that if it's a hot topic, they may alert the politicals and pull it. We've had that very same experience when I worked at The Sun, of people filing requests, usually with the Department of Defense or CIA or NSA or somebody, and it would take them years to get around to responding. And that reporter would have moved on. And in the old days, the package of documents would arrive in the newsroom and it would have that reporter's name on it. We would all laugh and then we would open it and use it. But now that it's electronic, if you weren't there anymore, where would it go? The email is dead. So it would sort of seem like if you filed requests that you still want to get after you've switched jobs or left that particular publication, you maybe need to refresh your FOIA request to give them a new contact. That's a thought. Or you can file simply with your personal email, both emails, so that you would be guaranteed of hearing from them.
I think you could probably still request the journalist exemption, as long as you're identifying as you're currently a reporter at the Arizona Republic. I'm not an attorney, but I think you could probably still do that, right? I also want to build on what you just said about Interior and, you know, point out that the Interior Secretary is joining us today, and would it be an interesting question to raise to her?
My hunch is that her communications director, Melissa Schwartz, will be here with her, because she travels with her almost everywhere. Mm-hmm. And she's the contact person we have had for discussing some of these issues. And so, you know, if you want to raise it as a question only, not as a speech, that's something to ask about. After our report came out, interestingly enough, detailing the backwalks and pointing out that Interior was worse than EPA, Interior did release a statement saying they had a plan for its expediting their and shrinking their backlog. I'm sure they were working on it before our report came out, but they felt compelled to at least be public about the fact that they're working on it.
Do we have any journalists who want to ask a question right now? If not?
Hi, Caleb Herringa, former journalist and now with Gas Leaks, an organization based on accountability around natural gas and the issues there. Had a question about kind of the when you're doing your initial request and you're not entirely sure what you're looking for, either because you don't quite know how the agency keeps records, how broad to be versus how specific. I know when you know requests can be denied if they're too broad, but just how when you're not quite sure what you're looking for, should you cast a wide net or try to be very specific and potentially miss something?
Well, you hit on that, the key problem with filing a blanket request, and I've done that myself. I've said, I want to see everything. Back in the old days when you could get paper documents, I got some good stories out of that. A chemical plant would have a fire, and you figure, there was probably some history here. You go ask to see the permit file, the whole permit file, right? It goes back years, and suddenly you find they've had these problems, and the inspector said, you're messing up, you got to fix it, and they didn't. That makes a great story. That's what I'm getting done to over $1,000 to try to see these days. They don't want to show that to you anymore. So ask for specific things, and maybe if you get some specific thing, then ask for another, or maybe that gives you a clue. One thing you can try, though, even these guys are hard to reach anymore, is to actually reach out to the agency communications people and ask them, what kinds of records do you have? What can we find out about this? I am able to get things through the press office at the State Environment Department, pieces, incrementally. If I asked to see the whole permit file, they would say, file a records request and get in line. And you'll hear from us in a couple of months. Let me show you a couple of other sort of links and groups that we're interested in sort of dealing with. And they also have, is anybody here a member of MuckRock? How many of you have heard of MuckRock? Okay, it's a collaborative, nonprofit collaborative news site, as they describe themselves, that specializes in records requests and gives you, they actually have tips on filing FOIAs here. I'll show it to you in a second. There, which is quite good, and they have good information there. One of the things that they also do, in addition to sort of helping journalists with FOIAs and documenting the FOIAs, they actually ask you to share them when you can feel you can, without giving away competitive information. They are generating some of their own reports and doing collaborative journalism. And some of those recent ones are environmental in nature. Still up on their website here. One of their members, one of their staff people, is an SEJ member. And I have been in touch with him about presenting a webinar and collaborating on some environmental projects. So if you're at all interested in that, again, send me your email. We will try to put something together here. I'm going to be in touch with him after the conference. And sometime soon, hopefully before the end of the year, we can pull something off.
If you want to just respond in the Google app, that might kind of generate some momentum. That could be nice, or if you prefer to be private about it.
Yeah, and the Google app would be good. Another group, have you heard of an environmental, EDGI, Environmental Data and Governance Initiative? I'm not surprised. It's a little bit more arcane. This is a group that started at the beginning of the Trump administration. There was a lot of, sort of former federal employees, agency employees, and others who were really afraid at that time, given the Trump administration, the Trump's campaign posture, and the people who were behind him, that they were about ready to basically wipe government websites of anything to do with climate change in particular. And so they went about archiving as quickly as they could everything on EPA, Interior, State Department, wherever, that had to do with climate change. Since then, of course, it didn't disappear, that it has evolved. And they actually analyze and use public records, analyze public databases, and use public records to get other data, and are generating their own reports. And they are interested in working with news organizations. They've done a couple collaborations. This is their website. And you'll see right up there highlighted their most recent report has to do with toxic chemicals and fracking. They did a report about a month ago on, and there's another one on enforcement. Been in touch with one of their people. They are highly interested in talking with us, with our members, and they're eager to collaborate if it works with one or several. In doing projects, and to help you with doing your own projects in terms of accessing data. So again, that's EDGI, E-D-G-I. And not necessarily the first EDGI you see on when you do a Google search either. I think that one's a medical one. So, okay?
Very good. We have
2 minutes left.
About 5 minutes left. So we are again open for any more discussion. I will point out that the toxic release inventory is, of course, one of the most accessible but yet difficult to manage databases related to pollution that the government, the U.S. federal government, has thrown out at the public and journalists and others. But I believe that data is as imperfect as it is an interesting model of at least an attempt at transparency, although the data is sometimes all there. And I think if we're dreaming of a future, we can see SEJ or other news organizations working with legislators at the federal level or people who manage agencies to try and create that same level of transparency, or even a higher level of transparency with other databases related to the environment. And that's something that I would open for feedback and conversation. It's a long-term project. Yeah, right.
All right. I'm Greg Stanley. I'm a reporter at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. On the environment beat, what struck me is how much of this stuff gets delegated from some of these big behemoth agencies, like the EPA is supposed to regulate feedlots. Feedlots are a huge problem with manure, and they're delegating that authority to the state, who in turn is delegating that authority to individual counties, we're finding out. So instead of having one place we can go to for inspection records, we're now trying to build our own database with 50 different counties.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, have you guys found any tools or helpful tips just finding out what information, what data does get kicked up federally in ways we can just figure out what data they're keeping, what data we might have access to versus trying to build our own?
Well, there's of course, in terms of our environmental stuff, there's the EPA ECHO database, which covers permitted facilities, and feedlots probably don't, a lot of them don't fall under the individual permit, though, right? Or the general permits, or?
Yeah, they do get permits, but it's issued to local.
So the data may be collected at a lower level in the federal government, and they may not kick it upstairs. That's a problem, obviously. I mean, it's a challenge for you. That may be totally legal the way they do it. It just means that you have to throw a net over each of those agencies to try to get their data. And sometimes you'll find that it's conflicting data where it has been kicked upstairs. I found this recently where I went on an EPA's ECHO database, saw a wastewater plant that had all kinds of compliance problems. It was spraying its effluent across farm fields, and I was like, oh my God. And so when I got finally an interview, it took a while, with the state agency, and said, what about this place? They said, oh. And they said, well, that's wrong. The data is wrong. They were reporting for the wrong outfall. And so, you know, you've got to sort of compare and contrast when you have different agencies getting the same data. You may get a story out of that too, which is that basically it, that system keeps everybody in the dark.
I want to invite, do we have any hands up back here? No, I want to invite Tim and Jaya, if you want to say a closing remark, you can. If not, it's okay.
Well, I just want to say that, if you ever want to get something released in San Francisco, do reach out. There is the Sunshine Task Force that is a watchdog organization, so you are lucky to, and one of the things that I found in the work that I've done is that there are very few people who actually do utilize the task force in terms of making complaints, and I feel that there needs to be more access, there needs to be more availability for everybody to understand that there are steps to take, especially in a city like San Francisco, where everybody's interested in, like, you know, information about the homeless or, you know, whatnot, to get your records released. And it should not fall on just a few people. I think it should be available to everybody.
Thank you, Tim.
And just like Jaya's anonymous, persistence pays off. You know, don't take no for an answer. Keep asking. You have to be patient. These have to be stories that are going to be around for a while. But typically, there's not a whole lot of new stories. I mean, the same issues are out there, and they're going to be there even if that particular story has moved on. So, getting the data, getting the information, even if it comes after you filed your story, could be worth an update. What I would urge you, if you have questions, if you have complaints, if you have problems, reach out to us. We can connect you with people who have a lot of experience filing for you, sometimes with the particular entity that you're working with. And we can also perhaps help answer some of your questions or recommend somebody that you could talk to about an appeal. That's the point of the task force, is to be there to help members and help journalists and to advocate for openness.
And I'll just say one quick plug for the obvious but developing sources within the agencies. If you're new to using FOIA and it seems like a huge long process, you're not wrong, but if you can find somebody within the agency, I've had the experience of somebody saying, like, we're having a conversation, I want some information, they say, I can't give it to you, and I say, well, what if I just shot you a Freedom of Information Act request? And they'll say, please, thank you. So it covers their, and giving you the information, because they're legally required to do it. So you never know. And develop those sources. Big thanks to Tim and Jaya. Big thanks.